Imagine standing in front of this massive, just incredibly heavy steel vault. And inside this vault is, everything you could possibly need to secure your future, to build this life of just absolute freedom. But there's no combination lock on the door. There's no keypad, no keyhole. Instead, sitting on a pedestal right in front of the vault, there's just a blank piece of paper and a pen. You don't get to like guess the password to get inside. You literally have to write it into existence. You have to author the key yourself. Welcome to the deep dive, because today we are looking at just six words. Six words that act as the prompt for that blank piece of paper.
And it is a incredibly profound starting point, honestly, because the entire foundation of our discussion today rests on literally just a single document title.
Yeah, just the pen.
Right? We don't have chapters, we don't have, bulleted lists or step-by-step tactics, and we certainly don't have some dense manual of instructions. We just have a phrase.
And what a phrase it is.
Exactly. The phrase is, quote, excerpts from Creating a Personal Wealth Plan. Creating a Personal Wealth Plan, end quote. That is the entirety of our source material for this deep dive.
I mean, when I first looked at the brief for today, I genuinely thought there had been a typo.
I don't blame you.
No, seriously, I was looking for the attachment. Like, where's the appendix? Where is the 200-page PDF I'm supposed to read? But no, it is just this title.
Just the label on the jar.
Yes. And my immediate reaction was, what on earth are we supposed to do with this? How do we explore a concept when all we have is the label, but the jar itself is completely sealed shut?
It's intimidating.
It really is. But then I sat with it. I really looked at the architecture of that specific string of words, and you realize a title is never just a label, is it? It's kind of it's a blueprint.
Exactly. Or, to stick with your vault analogy, it is the DNA of the entire philosophy you're about to engage with. We often treat titles as just, the wrapping paper.
Right, just tear it off to get to the good stuff inside.
Exactly. But in reality, a meticulously crafted title is a thesis statement. It completely establishes the rules of engagement. If the title of a document is fundamentally misunderstood, well, the reader is going to completely misinterpret every single page that follows.
Oh, absolutely.
The title sets the psychological posture of the reader. It demands a very specific frame of mind. If you don't understand the shape of the doorway, you cannot possibly understand the dimensions of the game you are about to walk into.
The shape of the doorway. I really want to hold on to that image because the frame of this particular doorway is very explicitly defined before we even get to the core concepts.
All right.
Because the text doesn't just announce itself as creating a personal wealth plan, it announces itself as excerpts from.
Yes.
Let's pause right there. When you, sitting there listening to this right now, hear the word excerpts, what happens in your brain? Because to me, it feels like stumbling across a movie trailer, or maybe finding this massive ancient book where all the pages are glued shut except for like three or four.
Which is a brilliant psychological trigger, right?
Yeah.
The phrase excerpts from casts this very specific shadow over the listener.
How so?
Well, by framing the text this way, the source immediately implies a larger unseen body of work. It tells you that a vast expanse of thought exists, but you are not being asked to traverse the entire landscape.
You're just getting a piece of it.
Exactly. Think about the etymology of the word excerpt. It actually comes from the Latin word excerpere, which literally means to pluck out.
Cluck out. Interesting.
Yeah, there is a selectivity, almost like a surgical precision, implied in the act of plucking something out of a larger hole.
But wait, let me challenge that for a second.
Go for it.
Does it actually elevate the material, or does it make us, suspicious? Because when I hear excerpts, a part of me immediately thinks, wait, what are you hiding?
Oh, that's a fair point.
Right. Like, who is the unseen hand doing the plucking, and what exactly did they decide I shouldn't see? Doesn't the word excerpt inherently mean we are getting an incomplete picture?
That is the perfect tension to point out. It absolutely does mean you are getting an incomplete picture. But the implication here is that the completeness of the original picture was perhaps too dense, or too wandering, or too raw.
Okay, so it needed editing.
Yes,
Hmm.
you do have to place immense trust in the unseen editor. But let's look at the cognitive effect of this. In an era where we are just absolutely buried under avalanches of content.
Oh my gosh, yes. Everything is so long now.
Right. Where every thought is a 10-hour video or a 500-page manifesto, offering excerpts is kind of an act of intellectual mercy.
Intellectual mercy, I like that.
It is a promise of distillation.
Yeah.
It signals to the reader, like, hey, We have spared you the journey. We're only giving you the destination.
So it's really about the signal-to-noise ratio.
Sounds accurate.
It's saying the fluff, the preamble, the throat clearing, and all those necessary but ultimately secondary deviations, they've all been burned away in a furnace.
Mm-hmm.
And what you are being handed is just the glowing ember that survived.
Precisely. And neurologically, think about how we respond to that. When we know we are reading an excerpt, our attention actually sharpens.
Because there's less of it to process.
Yeah. If I hand you a 500-page book, your brain paces itself. It knows it can skim. It knows there will be filler.
Right. You kind of glaze over certain parts.
Exactly. But if I hand you a single paragraph and tell you, listen, this is the only part that truly matters, you read every single syllable with hypervigilance.
You really do.
The negative space, you know, the hundreds of pages that were left on the cutting room floor forces the words that are present to carry immense concentrated weight.
It demands a higher level of intellectual respect.
Exactly.
You aren't just passively consuming, you are receiving a curated artifact. Okay, so we have this artifact. We are holding the glowing ember. And the very first word of the actual title of this unseen masterwork, the opening move, is an action.
Yes.
Creating.
And this is where the philosophical heavy lifting really begins.
It's fascinating because it doesn't say, you know, managing a personal wealth plan.
Right. It doesn't say protecting or inheriting or optimizing. It says creating.
Yeah.
It conjures up this image of an artist staring down a completely blank canvas.
Or an alchemist?
Yes, an alchemist trying to turn base metals into gold.
Yeah.
It is entirely generative. But I'm struggling with the reality of that word a little bit.
How so?
Is wealth really something you create from thin air? Because, I mean, we live in a physical world with finite resources. Are we actually inventors here, or are we just like hunters trying to capture something that already exists out in the wild?
That's a profound distinction. It is the difference between a zero-sum worldview and a generative worldview. And this title completely forces you into the latter.
Okay, unpack that.
Well, if the title had used capturing, acquiring, or accumulating, it would imply that wealth is this finite resource just wandering around in the external world.
Like a pie and you just want a bigger slice.
Exactly. In that scenario, your job is simply to build a better trap than your neighbor. Your gain is inherently someone else's loss.
Which is how a lot of people view it, honestly.
Yeah.
They do. Mm-hmm. But creating demands an entirely different, incredibly active posture. It implies that the plan is not a static net you throw into the river to catch passing fish.
Right.
It is an internal dynamic process of bringing something entirely new into existence that simply did not exist before you applied your energy to it.
Which is, man, that is an incredibly heavy burden to place on the listener.
It is.
Because if I am just managing something and it goes wrong, I can just blame the thing I am managing. I can blame the external environment. I can say, oh, the market was bad or the economy shifted.
Exactly. You have an out.
But if I am the one creating it, the locus of control rests entirely within me. There's no one else to blame.
And that is exactly the psychological mechanism at play here. The use of creating completely removes the comfort of the passive excuse.
It really does.
It is a declaration of ultimate unavoidable responsibility. The author of this title is essentially telling you, no one is coming to build this for you. You are the genesis point. And we have to look closely at the grammatical structure here, too, because the word is not create, it is creating.
Right.
It is a gerund, you know, the verb functioning as a noun ending in ing.
What's the functional difference there, though? Like, why does the ing matter so much?
Well, if the title were How to Create a Personal Wealth Plan, it implies a finite task.
Like checking a box.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It implies a checklist. Step one, step two, step three. You finish the task, you put the plan in a drawer, and you just walk away.
Done and dusted.
Right. But the ing suffix implies perpetuity. It is a continuous present tense. It implies a state of being rather than a discrete task.
You are never not creating.
Bingo.
So it's alive. It's breathing. It's like a painter working on a massive canvas. Every single brushstroke changes the context of the entire painting, which means the next brushstroke has to adapt to the new reality. It's just constant calibration. The you who started creating the plan on Monday is actually slightly different than the you calibrating the plan on Friday, because the very act of creating has changed you.
That is a beautiful way to understand it.
Yeah.
The plan is an evolving organism because the creator is an evolving organism. The king refuses to let you stagnate.
It keeps you moving.
Yes. It forces you to recognize that the moment you stop actively creating, the plan begins to decay. It requires a permanent state of active engagement.
Okay, so we've established that this requires you to be an active creator, right? An alchemist of your own life.
Yes.
You are holding the raw materials and you have to forge them into something. But alchemy implies you're trying to turn base metals into gold, which begs the question, what is your gold?
Right. What are you aiming for?
Exactly. Are you chasing society's definition of gold or your own? Because the source text insists on a very, very specific boundary here. It must be personal.
Creating a personal wealth plan.
Now, I have to play devil's advocate again here.
Please do.
Because a part of me reads personal and thinks, isn't that inherently obvious? And beyond just being obvious, isn't math just math?
What do you mean?
Like 2 + 2 = 4. The laws of compounding, the laws of addition and subtraction, they do not care about your personality type.
That's true.
They don't care if you are an introvert or an extrovert or what your hobbies are. So why does this document need to explicitly label the plan as personal in the actual title? Why emphasize the individual so heavily when the underlying mechanics are completely universal?
Because human beings are not algorithms.
Oh, that's good.
If human behavior were governed strictly by mathematics, we wouldn't need plans at all. We would just run a computer simulation and execute the output perfectly.
We'd all just be robots following the optimal path.
Exactly. The inclusion of the word personal is a radical, almost aggressive rejection of industrialized, one-size-fits-all solutions. The math might be universal, yes, but the emotional ecosystem that the math lives inside is entirely subjective.
The emotional ecosystem. I like that. Expand on that a bit, because when I hear personal, I kind of worry it means isolating.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, like if I'm building a strictly personal plan, am I cutting out my community? Does personal mean selfish in this context?
No, not selfish at all, but highly tailored. Let's look at how people usually approach planning.
Okay.
They look outward. They look at their neighbors. They look at their peers. They look at, you know, societal benchmarks. And they try to overlay those external templates onto their own lives.
Keeping up with the Joneses, essentially.
Exactly. The word personal acts as an absolute boundary against that instinct.
Yeah.
It tells you that comparing your plan to your neighbor's plan is not just unhelpful. It is fundamentally irrational.
Irrational? Why?
Because your neighbor is solving a totally different equation. They have a completely different tolerance for risk, a different generational history, different traumas, and different ultimate values.
No.
What constitutes a perfect, flawless, mathematically sound plan for one human being might be an absolute psychological nightmare for another.
I see. So it's a shield against the tyranny of generic advice.
Precisely.
Because we are constantly bombarded with these universal maxims, right? These absolute rules about how one must live, what one must prioritize, what one must achieve by age 30 or 40.
It's exhausting.
It really is. The word personal gives you permission to say, hey, that might be true for the collective, but it is not true for me. But that also requires an uncomfortable level of self-awareness, doesn't it?
It requires brutal honesty.
Yeah.
You cannot create a personal plan if you do not know who the person at the center of it actually is. You have to strip away the expectations of society, the lingering voices of your parents, the subtle pressures of your peers.
You really have to dig deep.
You have to interrogate your own desires. If the word creating gives you the power of the architect, the word personal demands that the building you design is one you actually want to live in, not just one that looks impressive from the street to passersby.
Wow. And we all know people who have built those impressive houses that they are absolutely miserable living inside.
Oh, absolutely.
They built a plan, but it wasn't a personal plan. It was a borrowed plan.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the friction between a borrowed plan and your authentic self will eventually tear the entire structure apart.
So we know the action creating, this perpetual generative state. We know the lens, personal, this brutally honest, deeply tailored boundary. But what are we actually aiming at?
Right.
What is the target of all this creation? This brings us to the most loaded, conceptually heavy word in the entire sequence. We are creating a personal wealth plan.
Yes.
Not a money plan, not a finance plan, not a savings plan, a wealth plan. To me, this is where the title completely elevates from a blueprint into a comprehensive philosophy of life.
The choice of the word wealth is perhaps the most significant linguistic decision in the entire text. It fundamentally redefines the horizon of the listener.
Let me try out a metaphor here, because I think the distinction between money and wealth is often completely lost on us today.
Please.
I think of wealth as an entire thriving ancient ecosystem, like a massive self-sustaining redwood forest.
Okay, I can picture that.
It has a canopy, it has an understory, it has root systems that communicate with each other, it regulates its own temperature, it is robust.
Right.
Whereas money or finances are just like the rain or the soil or the sunlight. You desperately need the rain. The forest will absolutely die without it. But the rain is just a component. A bucket of water is not a forest.
That's so true.
When we chase money, we are basically just running around with buckets trying to catch rain. But when we chase wealth, we are trying to cultivate the actual forest.
That is a phenomenal way to visualize it. Let's look at the roots, pun intended, of the word itself.
Oh, lay it on me.
The concept of wealth actually originates from the Old English word wella.
Wellala.
And wella did not mean a large pile of gold coins.
Mm-hmm.
It translated much more accurately to well-being, health, or prosperity in a broad, holistic sense.
Wait, really? It meant health?
Yes. It meant a state of flourishing. Over centuries, our modern industrialized society has violently contracted the definition of this beautiful word, reducing it to mere digits on a banking app or, you know, paper locked in a vault.
We've completely impoverished the word itself.
We have.
We took a word that literally meant flourishing and we turned it into a spreadsheet.
We did. But by deliberately choosing the word wealth over income or capital, the title is attempting to resurrect that older, grander definition.
It's reaching back to that original meaning.
Exactly. It is setting a much higher bar for the listener.
Mm.
Because a savings plan simply asks, are you hoarding enough resources?
Right.
A wealth plan asks a much more terrifying question. Is your life fundamentally abundant?
Man, that completely shifts how you evaluate your success, because you can have an absolute abundance of money and be entirely devoid of wealth.
Precisely. You can have millions of dollars and be time poor. You can be relationship poor. You can be health poor.
Oh, we see that all the time.
Right. You can have a bank account that is overflowing while your nervous system is in a state of constant collapse.
Exactly.
The source material does not promise a cash generation plan. By targeting wealth, it implies long-term sustainability. It challenges you, the listener, to consider time as a currency, to consider optionality, peace of mind, and physical vitality as tangible assets.
If I am just focused on money, my vision is narrow, I am focused on the immediate, the tangible, the very next transaction. I'm just looking down at my feet.
Right.
But if the target is wealth, the title forces me to pull the camera way back. I have to look at the horizon. I have to think in terms of decades, maybe even generations. The forest doesn't grow in a weekend, you know?
It takes time.
The word wealth intrinsically carries this idea of endurance and resilience, because a sudden windfall of money, like winning a lottery ticket, that can disappear overnight. But a wealthy ecosystem can actually weather a drought.
Exactly. It implies a fortress designed to protect the well-being of the individual. But a fortress or a forest does not organize itself by accident.
No, it doesn't.
And that brings us to the final word of the text. The mechanism that binds this entire soaring philosophy to the gravity of the real world.
Here we go.
We have the active, generative stance of creating. We have this subjective, fiercely individual lens of personal. We have the holistic, enduring goal of wealth. And finally, we arrive at the architecture itself. Plan.
Creating a personal wealth plan.
Pan.
Okay, here is where my brain starts firing in a million directions, because plan is such a double-edged sword.
Oh, absolutely.
If you're listening to this right now, think about how often you create plans for your day, for your week, for a project at work. A plan fundamentally forces you to look at the future. It is a declaration of intent about a time that hasn't even happened yet.
Right.
But here's my concern. If you are constantly focused on this future plan, always trying to organize tomorrow, do you risk losing touch with the present?
That is the danger, yes.
Does the rigidity of a plan destroy the spontaneity of living right now? Like, does writing a plan essentially lock you into a cage of your own making?
That is the eternal friction of the human condition right there. It's the battle between the present self, who just wants to experience life right now, and the future self, who desperately needs to be protected and nurtured.
It's a tug of war.
It is. But let's look at the cognitive science of what a plan actually does to the human brain. Because the future is inherently chaotic. It is an endless dark ocean of variables, risks, unseen dangers, and unknowns.
It It's terrifying, honestly.
Exactly. The human mind is biologically terrified of that chaos. It causes profound underlying anxiety.
Because we are wired for certainty. We want to know where the threats are coming from.
Exactly. When you don't have a plan, your brain is forced to keep all of those future variables actively spinning in your working memory.
Like having too many tabs open on your browser.
Yes. Perfect analogy. In psychology, there is a concept called the Zeigarnik effect.
The Zeigarnik effect.
Right. It states that humans remember uncompleted or interrupted tasks far better than completed ones.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
So when you have a vague desire for wealth, but no actual plan, your brain treats it as a massive unresolved task. It generates this low-grade, constant hum of cognitive anxiety. The word plan in this title is essentially a psychological release valve.
Wait, so the act of planning is actually a way of offloading anxiety from your brain onto the paper?
Yes. A plan is an organizing principle. It is an attempt to take the terrifying, amorphous blob of the future and bring some semblance of structured order to it today.
Wow.
When you write it down, you satisfy the Zeigarnik effect. The brain says, okay, we have a framework for this. We can stop worrying about the abstraction and just execute the next step.
Yeah.
It frees you up to actually live in the present because the future has been structurally accounted for.
But what about the rigidity? I mean, life never, ever goes according to plan.
No, it doesn't.
So aren't we just setting ourselves up for failure? Like, if I write a plan today and tomorrow the entire world changes, my plan is useless.
Well, this is where we have to redefine what a plan actually is. Mm-hmm. A plan is not a train track. If you are on a train track, and there's a massive boulder on the rails ahead, you crash. You have zero optionality.
Right.
A proper plan, especially a personal one, created through that continuous ing process we discussed earlier, is not a track. It is the keel of a sailboat.
The keel, like the heavy fin at the bottom of the boat under the water.
Exactly. What does a keel actually do? It doesn't force the boat to go in one unchangeable direction. It provides resistance against the water so that when the wind shifts, when the chaotic storms of life happen, you don't just blow sideways helplessly.
Oh, that is brilliant.
The keel gives you the stability to tack against the wind. You might have to zigzag. You might have to change your route entirely. But the plan, the keel, keeps you upright and moving generally towards your destination rather than just drifting at the mercy of the environment.
I love that. It provides resistance. It gives you something to push off against.
Exactly.
Because without the word plan at the end of this title, creating personal wealth is just an abstract desire.
It's nothing.
It's a daydream. It is a wish whispered into the wind. The addition of plan turns the abstract desire into a tangible, structured intention. It demands manifestation.
Yes, it does.
You literally have to map your invisible hopes onto the physical reality of a document.
It is the bridge between the philosophical and the practical. And it is a bridge built between two distinct entities.
Yeah.
Who you are right now and who you intend to be.
The dialogue with the stranger. Well, the you of today is basically writing a plan for the you 10, 20, 30 years from now. But you don't actually know that future person.
Right.
They will have different tastes, different aches and pains, completely different priorities. The plan is the medium through which the present self communicates with the future self.
That is the ultimate synthesis of these six words. I mean, let's look at the entire sequence one last time.
Yeah.
Excerpts from Creating a Personal Wealth Plan. It is a complete, self-contained philosophical system.
It really is staggering when you step back and look at the whole mechanism.
It is.
Because it begins with the psychological framing of excerpts, right? Promising us a curated high-yield distillation, commanding our focus and respecting our overloaded minds.
Then it moves immediately to the action, creating. It totally rejects the passive stance, rejects the victim mentality, and places the locus of control squarely on your shoulders in a perpetual, never-ending state of generation.
Then it draws the boundary line. Personal.
Yes.
It forces you to look inward, to ignore the noise of the crowd, to reject societal templates, and to be brutally honest about your own unique emotional ecosystem.
And it defines the horizon. Wealth. It refuses to let you settle for mere financial accumulation, demanding instead that you aim for holistic well-being, for a robust, enduring life forest rather than a transient bucket of rain.
And finally, it anchors the entire soaring vision to the earth with a plan.
Providing the keel for the sailboat.
Exactly. Offloading the cognitive anxiety of the unknown future and forcing the abstract dream into a tangible structure. Six words. Just six words. Acting as an absolute portal.
It is the architecture of thought. Which I know sounds incredibly lofty.
It does a bit.
But all it really means is, if your blueprint says you're building a shed, You can't be surprised when you don't end up with a mansion.
That's perfectly said.
The title is the blueprint. We have spent all this time standing in the doorway, analyzing the frame. We've traced the grain of the wood. We've examined the hinges. We've explored the implications of the threshold.
You've looked at every single atom of the doorway.
But the doorway is just the beginning. I really want to leave the listener with a final thought experiment.
Okay.
Think about what happens when you finally turn the handle, push open that door, and sit down at the desk inside. Sitting there is that blank piece of paper we talked about at the very beginning.
Right.
If creating a personal wealth plan is just the title, what is the very first word you write on page one to begin? Not the numbers, not the math. What is your actual personal starting line?
Wow. What is your starting line? If you are listening to this right now, whether you're driving or walking or sitting at your desk, I want you to let that question echo in your mind today. What is the first word on your blank page?
That's a big question.
It really is. Thank you so much for joining us on this incredible deep dive. We started with what seemed like a typo, a microscopic fragment of text, and we've journeyed through the psychology of intention, the burden of creation, and the architecture of an abundant life.
It's been quite a ride.
Keep questioning the things that seem simple. Keep looking for the universes hidden inside the microscopic details. And above all, take that active creative stance in your own life. You are the architect. We'll see you next time.